You are listening to our abduction special, Dr. David Jacobs.
The history of abductions goes back, we think, and this is a guess, an educated guess, but a guess, that it probably goes back to maybe the late 19th century. The first case that we knew about is in 1957 in Brazil. A young man claimed that he was abducted into a UFO. There was odd things that happened, sometimes even sexual in nature. He duly reported this to researchers in Brazil. It was so horribly embarrassing and so off the wall for UFO researchers who are only 10 years down the line with knowledge of the UFO phenomenon in general, that the case was not published until many years later. After this case, which nobody knew about, there was the famous Barney and Betty Hill case. Barney and Betty Hill were an interracial couple who were traveling in New Hampshire on their way back from Canada to the United States, and they had a two-hour time gap on the way home, essentially, to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Investigations a few years later found out that they had been abducted. After Barney and Betty Hill sort of came out in public and there was a book written about them in 1966, we began to get a trickle of other abduction accounts. Finally, by the late 1970s, a man by the name of Bud Hopkins began to research some sightings and other sort of events that had happened to a friend of his who lived across the street. When he published an article about this sort of series of events that had happened, which included multiple witnesses, it included occupant sightings, as they used to call them, on the ground, he began to get an enormous amount of mail from people who had similar experiences. He then took the abductees, or the people who didn't even know that they were abducted, actually, to a psychologist who knew nothing about the subject at all, and had her do hypnosis to see why it was that a lot of these people had missing time sequences. They seemed to be missing, didn't know where they were, and nobody else knew where they were or could see them. It was obvious that he was onto something much more in-depth and much more serious than I had ever imagined.
And that was a woman who remembers vividly waking up at night, and she had gray at the foot of her bed. A fairly familiar story. In fact, it was one of Bud Hopkins' subjects or people he investigated, or ever how you want to phrase it, the late, great Bud Hopkins. We have a friend of the late, great Bud Hopkins with us right now. He's walking back to his apartment where he's staying. He's been out in Tempe, Arizona for a little while. Peter Robbins, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, Jerry. A bit warm, but doing very well, and glad to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's probably, what, 93, 94 degrees, something like that?
Something like that. And as they say, it's a dry heat, though.
Yeah.
You're more like in an oven than in a sauna.
Yeah, and when you get in the sun there, it eats you alive.
Better, though.
Anyway, man. Peter, say hello to Craig Lang and Elaine Douglas.
Hey, Elaine, how are you doing? And hi, Craig.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, Peter?
What were you doing out in Tempe? Did you make some sort of lecture this weekend?
Yeah. Phoenix MUFON and Sedona MUFON invited me out to give some talks Friday and Saturday, updates on the Rendlesham case, and I tied it in with some other business and am filling my time very nicely and spending some of my days at the offices of the terrific Open Minds organization, where I've got a number of friends, and they're letting me set up my computer in an empty cubicle and get some work done and hang out with them. And my week is going quickly. Saturday I'll fly back to Ithaca and the East Coast.
Now, when we talk about Hopkins, you have some firsthand experience. If you were on the air with me and you explained to me that your sister actually had an abduction story, and that's how you met Bud Hopkins. Is that right?
Well, you're absolutely right, Jerry. We go back when Bud passed last year at 80. We had just marked our 35th year as friends and colleagues. Bud and I met in 1976, which was 5 years before he published his first book, which, of course, was Missing Time, that really put him on the map. And I met him because my sister, in 1975, had first shared memories with me of her abduction-related experiences. It's very close to my sister. She didn't spin things. She was a good-hearted person. And 1975, this was not something that was, a staple of talk shows, of documentaries, of books. I didn't know anything about it. I think I had heard something about Betty and Barney Hill in a special issue of Life magazine when I was a kid, but I was just very, very upset when she told me about it. And up until that moment in my life, I had a very clear career track. I was already a graduate of Eiffel Fine Art School in the United States, the School of Visual Arts in New York. I was on their faculty. I was an aspiring young painter in New York City. Bud was more an established painter. And I was doing my best to educate myself to what had happened to my sister. And about a year into this, 1976 as it turned out, I picked up a copy of a New York weekly called The Village Voice, which hardly is a paper that one would associate with UFOs as a subject. And much to my surprise, there in the paper was an article about a remarkable case that had occurred the year before in New Jersey. And I had been doing reading a lot of it, you know, you get what you can, and this is the mid-70s, some of it pretty harebrained or lighter-than-air Welcome to Space Brothers stuff. And I was realizing there was a scientific body of work that I was beginning to connect with. I was not really keen on meeting a lot of folks who were in the field because I thought they had to be a little loopy. I knew my sister was fine and I was fine. And I read this article, and the first thing that struck me was it was particularly well-researched and very well-written. And the author was this guy named Bud Hopkins. And it mentioned in the liner note that he was a painter. And I thought, good Lord, I think I've seen his work in the galleries. And I you know, maybe it wasn't the most polite thing to do, but in early 1976, after I read the article, I simply cracked the giant New York City phone book. There was one Bud Hopkins in the phone book. And I cold called him, and I introduced myself as a fellow painter who was interested in UFO studies and whose sister seems to have had an experience, and I wondered if I could chat with him. And he asked me a few questions, ironically, more about what my artwork was like than anything else. And he invited me to come over and have coffee. And, of course, we have no way of knowing in life when things are taking a major turn. And a few days later, I showed up at his door of his kind of funky townhouse on... sorry about that background noise. I'm very close to the Phoenix airport.
That's fine.
And he invited me in. He was smart. He was sharp. I loved his house. It was filled with art and books and just radiated intelligence and interest. And we started a friendship then. And on and off over the next years, usually every couple of months, we'd get together, talk, have coffee, talk about art and UFOs. And then 5 years later, he finished this extraordinary study, establishing him as the true pioneer of UFO abduction studies. And his life began to change very dramatically. He went from Bud Hopkins, professional painter and family man and intellectual, to the Bud Hopkins that we now look back on as the pioneering UFO abduction investigator who's known worldwide. And within a short time, he was starting to get mail from people from all over the country, then around the world, and he needed an assistant. I was living most of my life kind of out of the box, and I started to volunteer a few days a week. And on and off over the next 20-odd years, I worked by his side through several hundred abduction cases. I was in an extraordinarily privileged position and have consider myself very fortunate that I've had the vantage that I've had to look at this from literally right over his shoulder. I'm one of those people who does not have the luxury of disbelief, Jerry. And that's one of the reasons why I have to keep my critical facilities sharp and my skepticism sharp. And to go off on a 60-second tangent, I think in the field, a lot of good colleagues, because they know it's real, they've seen the preponderance of the evidence, they just go right into the next investigation, assuming this is probably what it is. Where I basically force myself to begin right at the bottom again and work my way up. And as maybe you've discussed a bit or will be discussing, we're not just talking about people who allege that they've had these extraordinary experiences. There is an associated battery of physical proofs and multiple witnesses and, in many cases, truly anomalous health histories and missing pregnancies, implants, scarification that happens overnight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I not only got to spend time with these people, handle these proofs, but many of them said, you know, talk to my family. Here's the contact information for my obstetrician or my psychologist, my therapist. And so it went. I witnessed more hypnotic regressions than I can remember. I was an adjunct, so to say, when Bud started support groups. I was there and often the only person that had not been through this. My dear sister benefited very much from her time working with Bud and facing her concerns and fears and confusions and that solidarity of being with other people who had the same experiences and realizing, good Lord, this is just what happened to me. So, again, I consider myself extremely, extremely lucky, if that's the word, for getting caught up in this madness. And I, you know, I can question individual cases, but the phenomenon for me, it is not something visionary or fictitious, to paraphrase General Twining's in his famous September 1947. But a genuine phenomenon.
Before we go any further, Craig and Elaine and I were discussing bloodlines and whether or not these things go in families.
Yes.
So I have to ask you, Peter, and I never have.
Yes.
Have you had an abduction experience? Your sister did.
That's a great question, and it makes all the sense in the world. No is the short answer. How do I know that with some certainty? I have put myself in a position where I have been regressed three different times by three different hypnotists, including Bud, including one of my other mentors, a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective who was a crack UFO investigator, Pete Mazzola, who too few people in the field know about. He died much too young, but who, along with Bud and the late Coleman von Kavetsky, all taught me to investigate this phenomena without any mystical fanfare, but more like law enforcement looks into felonies and criminal activity. And the other reason that I am convinced that nothing happened to me is because there are instances when a sibling, a husband or wife, parents are literally shut off when the other person is taken. And
yeah,
I requested all my hypnotists to ask me as many probing questions as possible. Among the sort of list of a priorities that Bud and people like John Mack and Dave Jacobs and other pioneering investigators put together was a rather quirky list of extreme phobias of, you know, as a child going missing and being found later in a different location, but with a perfect little corduroy scoop mark on your knee and no blood on your pants or what have you. Very strange, unusual fears. If you're a woman, the fact that you seem to be pregnant and then all of a sudden you weren't pregnant, missing fetus syndrome, and on and on and on. And I thought, you know, here I am working for 20 years with these people, and I'm saying this from the heart, and if anybody does voice stress analysis and they're recording this, you can actually do voice stress analysis, VSA technology, from a first-generation recording. Check me out. But nothing has rattled loose in the last 37 years, so I'm going to guess that that's really the case. However, to address this bloodline thing, when we, the UFO research community, really began to look at this, small core of people like Bud, in earnest, in the 70s, the logical mind suggested that if such things happened, it was probably about the same odds as, you know, winning a $10 million lottery and getting hit by lightning. If you're picked up by these other intelligences, it's a fluke. You know, they grab you, they examine you, they let you go. What, of course, we now know, based on hundreds and hundreds of careful case studies, is it's just the opposite. If it happened to you once, it has probably happened to you on and off throughout your life, beginning when you were very young, and it probably happened to one of your parents and to one of their parents and so on and so on. This is chilling. It sounds absolutely wild to people that have not studied the literature or have an appreciation of what we're talking about. It's simply the way it is.
Craig and Elaine, feel free to jump in here with any conversation or any questions you want to ask.
I have a bunch of them, but I don't think we've ever met, Peter, but Ms. Craig Lang. I don't know if you. I know I met Bud a number of times. I really miss him. He was cool. I love him.
Yeah.
Has your family had other histories of experiences?
Well, like of course, that's a great question. When Helen and I first discussed this in 1975. It took me some months to really wrap my head around it and to begin to educate myself. And we waited about a year or two until we sat down with Mom and Dad. And this was all triggered by a phenomenal memory from childhood that had simply been repressed until it emerged for a number of reasons. I could go into why I think they happened. My memory of a phenomenal daylight sighting that we had together as kids on the front lawn of the house we grew up in a village on Long Island, New York, about 30 miles from Manhattan. And when we finally sat down with Mom and Dad, they were really taken aback, quite shaken up, but they didn't call us liars or anything. We were good kids and we were good adults. And I started to show my mom and Dad some of the literature that was beginning to come up, and just, they weren't really comfortable with it, but my dad more so than my mom. In fact, he started to read the books. There was, I remember one wonderful day where he came to work with me and spent the day with Bud and me in Bud's studio, asking questions, you know, looking at stuff. He liked Bud very much. So did my mom, who also met him. But my mom was always more reticent. And I consider myself a good investigator, but boy, oh boy, I had a moment in my life, I guess this has to be about 15 years ago. It may seem, you know, to you guys, well, you should have asked your parents right off the bat if they thought they had anything like this. It was just kind of an awkward thing to ask our mom and dad this, and I had other things on my mind. But a few years before my mom died, she was a first-generation Russian Jewish immigrant, and an extraordinary woman, extremely intelligent, very vivacious at some times, very kind of reflected at others. And we were having a vodka together, and she said, you know, when Helen first talked about this, it was very unnerving for me. But having read some of the material, I now appreciate that such things happen. And I've met some of your friends that, you know, also have had it happen. I haven't read the books. They make me a bit anxious, to be honest with you. But I've gone through them. I've seen some of the television shows. And I wanted to share something with you. I said, what's that, Mom? She said, I think it may have happened to me. And I think I kept a straight face, but inside I froze. I just, you know, call it evasion of the obvious, but it was overwhelming to me that this could have happened to my mother. Of course, it's the most logical thing in the world, in a sense. And I said, oh, yeah, whatever. And she said, yeah, I have this indentation in my back that I didn't have at a certain point when I was a kid, and then all of a sudden one of my sisters noticed, and you want to take a look at it. And I said something like, oh, well, maybe another time, and I just freaked. I couldn't handle, you know, yeah, Mom, sure, I want to look at your alien abduction scarf. That's what it is. And a few years later, she was gone, and that opportunity passed. So that's the long answer to your short question. It does seem,
yeah,
I can only deduce that that is a strong possibility on my mom's side of the family.
Were
yes.
there other, were there other unusual things in the family line too, like psychic experiences, shamanic, or like I hear a lot where it seems to go down the maternal family line too, is what I've noticed. You know, it's a lot of times the husbands or brothers will be unaffected, kind of like you're describing. But the it's where, you know, they'll describe mom was a psychic, grandma was a healer back in the old country, and the daughter is like an indigo child, things like that.
But to be honest with you, not really. If there was, okay. I missed it. My sister was always very intuitive. She, like me, chose to kind of follow a different path in life. I began my life as a painter and became a writer. I worked in the theater for many years, off-Broadway theater management of a repertory company. And I've always considered myself something of an outsider. Helen maybe even more so. She was a poet who became a fairly well-known rock and roll singer in New York, who really lived life on her own terms, very outspoken, didn't really care what people thought of what she maintained had happened to her. So her role in life ultimately, in part, as an educator and somebody to just be an example of, yeah, this stuff happens, it happened to me, and I've got my dreams and my life and my friends, and, you know, I don't let it run my life. But no, I guess the closest I could say is my mother's mother, my Nana, was she came over from Russia, and she was basically an illiterate person in terms of writing, but she was about the smartest person I knew in terms of practical things. She was a marvelous cook. She was a great storyteller. She was the one most in touch with her emotions. But other than that, no. And again, it's not something I explored with my mom's mom or her sisters and things. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't have occurred to me in a funny way. Again, call it evasion of the obvious. This is my family.
Right.
Let me jump in here for a minute. Elaine, Peter brought something up with Craig that I thought was pretty important. And I've noticed this with over the years of people I've interviewed, and Peter and Craig, you can comment as well.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that many of these abductees are creative, artistic.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't you noticed that?
Well, many of them are. Many of them are. But having, again, sat through more support group meetings than I can remember, meeting with tremendous numbers of them simply by being in the office. And when I say several hundred, I'm not spinning numbers, easily several hundred over 20 years, but I think worked closely with close to 1,000 people over the years, you know, maybe it's 900 or something, and many of them were not very creative. You know, they were doctors, lawyers.
So in other words, it's kind of the gambit which we talked earlier, where the fellow who's a janitor called
in. Across the board, Jerry, every profession, character type, socioeconomic background, race, religion, predisposition, sexual preference, you name it. And being in New York City, in a way, maybe we had a more compelling demographic because everybody and their mother and brother is represented in New York City. It wasn't like doing the same kind of studies in Kansas City or in Keokuk, Iowa, or
wherever.
Anywhere else, exactly. So we had a remarkable, rich group of people because they happened to be in New York, because they happened to find Bud one way or the other, and begin to work with them and attend support group meetings or come by the office. Again, many of them did one hypnotic regression. Some did none. Many did quite a number. And one of my many office jobs was to label these tapes. If requested, make a copy for the individual, which I think was often the case. Log them in, you know, very analog system and a big old-fashioned ledger in box after box after box, and maintain the files, some of which contain Bud's notes, others transcriptions of tapes, others, when we were allowed and given permission, medical records or communications from their therapist or what have you, sometimes CAT scans, x-rays, when it involved implants, which came up, you know, not every day, but it certainly was a thread that worked its way through it, and that is certainly physical evidence to see an anomalous object subcutaneously under the skin without a scar, and every once in a while in a place that not only it shouldn't be, but that it couldn't be. My most dramatic one I'm remembering was a first-generation big old x-ray, and right there in somebody's skull, let's say an inch and a half down and 2 inches in slightly to the right or whatever, was something that just registered as a hard, regular shape. There was no question in anyone's mind, medical or lay, that it had no business being there. And these things were usually round like a BB or elongated like a grain of rice or something.
Yeah.
Silicone-based, metallic-based, whatever. And we can only make educated guesses as to their purpose. And there aren't that many options, control, tracking, influence, what have you.
We haven't discussed implants much tonight. I'm glad you brought that up, Peter. It's pretty common with abductees that they do have some sort of markings on their body. And
yes,
if you further investigation, ends up there's an implant of some sort.
Yes, or that it's marked that doesn't have anything to do with an implant. The classic ones that, for me, are the most memorable are reminiscent of nothing more than a tiny, tiny little micro-miniature ice cream scoop, where it's sort of a perfect and a half circle. But again, there's never a period of time, ever, that we came in contact with where it scabbed over. It was just instantly cauterized. Then there were like surgical scars on some people that
looks like a punch biopsy.
Night. Yeah, woke up the next day and, you know, there's a scar, a 2-inch line in a certain part of their anatomy, and they'd be in a number of different places. And all of these were photographed, documented, logged in, and became part of our database.
You did an appearance, I think, a couple of months ago in one of Bud Hopkins' most famous patients or clients or whatever what you want to phrase it. Linda Cortega was there. Isn't that, is my memory right? Didn't you do something with Linda Cortega recently?
I did. A rather remarkable program of kind of ufological education is going on at a small college in western New York State, and I wish representatives from every university and college could have a window in on this. It began with a professor of anthropology, a respected man named Phil Hasley, who I have great, great admiration for, a professor of anthropology who also happens to be, and I'm not using his name out of school, it's not a secret thing or anything, he is a state section director of MUFON in western New York State. And because of his interest, this small school, which is called Niagara County Community College, and it's very close by Buffalo and actually not that much of a ride from the legendary Niagara Falls, some years back he invited a UFO speaker. I forget who the first one was, but it went over very well. The students found it fascinating. Obviously, the administration did not feel hideously embarrassed. Everybody reported that it was a most intriguing conversation, and then they hired another. I spoke in there a number of times. Travis Walton has now spoken, Bud, Leslie King, and Richard Dolan, and a handful of other respected researchers and investigators. First time I spoke there, they said they expected 70 people. They had close to 300. The next day, I spoke for a 70-odd person anthropology class as a guest lecturer. And what happened most recently was, I think it was March 31st, they had a panel discussion, and a very unusual one it was. It was Linda Corfield, who had not spoken in public for many years, continues to live in the same home, that apartment house in Lower Manhattan. She's lived in for many years, including during these events. A Reverend Stephen Cox, who is a state section director and who is the publisher of New York State's monthly MUFON bulletin, a great gal named Cookie Stringfield, who is the head of a very well organized meetup group coming out of Rochester, New York, where they have these terrific meetings every month with great speakers, and David Jacobs. And Dave spoke, and Linda spoke. I moderated, and then they had a discussion, and then we took questions. Well, the kicker was for me, this is a pretty rural part of New York State. It's not got a lot of money and things, and their policy is students can go for free, but folks in the community are invited for a $3 donation, which always goes to a local hospice. And I'll tell you what, my big surprise was over 500 people showed up. And the percentage of students was rather modest. The percentage of local folks was huge. And they were not there to mock or to roll their eyes or to, you know, ask stupid questions. They were there because they find this subject very compelling. I will also say from a number of visits up there that there is maybe a slightly elevated percentage of abductees, at least among the folks that I've met, and there is interest in the community, and son of a gun, it was a heck of a night. Very thoughtful, reflective, intelligent questions were asked, and this is something that, you know, in an ideal world could be going on at institutions of higher learning. I'm just thankful we have academics like Professor Phil Hasley and open-minded colleges like Niagara County Community College, and I hope that maybe somebody who's listening to me now who's affiliated with the university or college may look into this and consider hiring, you know, a respected UFO author or researcher to come and speak at their school. It's not going to embarrass them in the least. In fact, it might just add to the credibility in the big picture.
The reason I mentioned Linda is this Brooklyn Bridge UFO experience, and maybe our audience doesn't realize what happened. And I have a kind of a naive question for you, Peter, but
sure.
I'm going to ask it anyway. She floated out of that window, right, into a UFO?
Yes.
Did she ever explain exactly how that happened, or was she aware of it at the time?